of times there's really good DX on 20 meters, and I'm able to reach them. I can work them, you know. I find that if there's one, you know, there's probably going to be two or three from the same place.
Sometimes, but not necessarily all times. I mean, I've mentioned before, I think a guy named John who operates out of Namibia. And I must have talked to him at least three times. And I haven't talked to anyone anywhere near him. So, you know, sometimes it's just a lone guy with a possibly a very, very nice setup.
Well, we're at Cyprus Station 5B4AMX, and then maybe a few days later I'll learn 5B4VL, and 5B4VL confirm. And I remember maybe a year and a half ago, I worked South Africa, and I must have worked about eight stations from South Africa in like a week.
Okay, well, I guess propagation conditions were just good for that, Ed, but very stable. I've had vaguely similar things on 10 meters in the United States. I've mentioned it before. Like, there was one time, all of a sudden, I got five contacts in a medium-sized town in Nebraska. None of them knew each other, so it wasn't like it was a coordinated series of contacts. It's just that a kind of refraction kind of set up a direct connection between Brooklyn and that town in Nebraska. But being 10 meters, you know, it's like a river flowing. If you wait a little while, it'll change its course by you know, significant enough to lose the contacts. So, I mean, that worked well for about 30 minutes or so, and then I was done talking to anyone in Nebraska. I guess 20 meters, the propagation conditions are a wee bit more consistent.
Oh, Roy, I got to tell you, I wait for the propagation. The propagation is there. There's lots and lots of good QSOs and lots of DX. You know, you can have a nice conversation with someone in a foreign country, and, you know, it's certainly worthwhile, I think. Fulfilling would be another word for it. And, you know, I'd rather wait until the signals are really good before I really invest my time and effort in it.
Okay, I certainly do understand it. My way of going about it, especially when it comes to 10 meters, is I'm running a net that has a set time. So I have to accomplish whatever I'm accomplishing between 11 o'clock and 1 o'clock. I can't wait for any random time and then tell people to come join me on the net. So, you know, as an individual operator, you do have a lot more leeway of choosing your times and situations.
Yeah, but, you know, someone who has a minimal ham radio setup, you know, an antenna, maybe a decent antenna, and a good small radio, you know, how to say, they can do really well with a good propagation. Yes, it is possible for a minimal station to make these contacts on 20 meters.
Yeah, I mean, just because you can't afford a contest station doesn't mean that you can't enjoy the hobby. It requires a little bit more motivation and determination. And I've mentioned before, there was a guy, I think he wrote a book, and he started an antenna selling company. But before he did that, he wrote a story about how he just wanted to know how minimum your setup could be to get away with things. So he took a 100-watt incandescent light bulb, he fastened it on the top of a 5 or 6 foot wooden post and hooked it up and tuned it to a 100 watt transmitter, and he ended up getting a worked all state certificate just using that setup, just to kind of demonstrate that if you're motivated enough, you can do all kinds of things with very, very low quality equipment.
Yeah, 100%. I agree with that. And then, of course, the propagation helps a lot.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, if you don't have propagation, then you're not going to get lucky. I mean, something has to happen. Those radio waves have to get from you to the other guy, and they're traveling in the ionosphere and refracting. If they're not refracting, then they're not getting there. So, but the random element is the propagation conditions. They're given to change. And the more time you spend in front of the radio waiting for them to be better, the better the chance of making the contact. So, you know, you can't just kind of sit there and curse the darkness. You got to go find yourself a candle.
I listen to my radio at least twice a day, three times a day. You know, when there's activity, then I decide what I want to do. But think about mobile radios, you know, when you're operating 10 meters or 15 meters or 20 meters or even 40 meters on a mobile whip mounted on the back bumper of your car, you know, and make these DX contacts from a mobile station, you know, why not take the mobile station and make it part of like a base, where the antenna's outside and the ability to make the contact is very similar?
Well, I'm sure there's a whole bunch of different reasons. The first one that pops into my head is, the bane of homeowners associations. You try and put an antenna up. Nowadays, even if you kind of try and trick them by putting an antenna that's a flagpole, they'll knock on your door and they'll tell you to take it down. I don't know what they have against antennas, but they seem to hate them. So there's a lot of people who have limited abilities to get any kind of antenna where they live. Either they live in an apartment complex and their landlord doesn't want it, or they could be living in an assisted living facility or a homeowners association. There's a whole bunch of different reasons why they simply can't get an antenna out, and so they go mobile or they go portable as the best option they have available for themselves.
QSL. Well, I took a pair of Phantom mobile whip antennas for 20 meters, and I attached them to a dipole mount. And I set it up on top of a photo tripod, and it operates 15 watts. I made two contacts, one right after the other, you know, from inside my apartment. And the antennas were in the middle of the apartment. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's depending upon all kinds of conditions, that can work. Every so often I'll talk to a guy who has some wires stapled to the side of the wall of their apartment, one room in their apartment, and they get out to one degree or another. You know, compromises almost always work to some degree or another. I've mentioned before on the 10-meter net, I at one point or another I got either bored or goofy, and one of the other guys I was having a conversation with lives about a mile away and not too many obstructions. So we both switched our antenna feeds to our dummy loads and we continued the conversation. So a leaky dummy load can get contacts, not the greatest contacts, but they can get you some contacts.
KG2RY. Well, I had a friend. He passed away. He's a silent key. He ran a wire along the wall to the ceiling of his dwelling, and he also attached another coil and another wire so that he could operate from 10 to 80 meters CW, and he ran about 50 or 60 watts of power, and he made plenty of contacts, most of them inside of Europe, but he figured out how to make it work for him inside, you know?
Yeah, it's possible. It's not easy. It also depends upon, you know, what your apartment is made of. My particular house is kind of a Faraday cage, so I wouldn't be terribly optimistic of getting much out of it. I remember I set up a magnetic loop receiver in my shack just to set everything up and make sure everything was tight and connected. And I listened to the received signal, and it was very, very sad. I was a little concerned, but I grabbed it and I took it out to the backyard and set it up there, and it was much, much, much better. So the inside of my walls, I wouldn't say are optimum for RF. So we got a bit of a Faraday cage going on here, but so I just learned from my lesson and put my antennas outside, and it's been working for me since then. But there are guys who don't have any Faraday cages in their apartments or their houses, and the RF just kind of bleeds right through, and for them, they can get away with stapling a long length of wire.
QSO. Well, I had a 220 megahertz and mobile whip antenna. I attached it to an NMO mount on my air conditioner, ran the wire around my apartment into the back of the transceiver, and how to say, it wasn't great, but it was okay.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, 99% of us have to compromise in some form. Very few people have the opportunity to set up antenna farms in acres of land right outside the back of our shacks. So, you know, it's what you can live with. You know, if you want the finest station, then you're going to have to pay a lot of money for it. Especially in the metropolitan area, there's probably no location that's really optimum. You'd have to go into the suburbs or farmlands or such. But you learn to deal with what you can, and people do that in other hobbies as well. There are astronomy guys, and they have telescopes, and the glare of the atmosphere is not really optimal to kind of look at the stars. From places like Brooklyn and such. But they do it nevertheless because they don't intend to move out to Arizona and Nevada and such, and they just want to look at the stars in Brooklyn.
QSO. Well, sometimes even the QSOs are not optimal. It's 5'9 and 73.
Yeah, yes indeed.
So yeah, but the ones that are really good, the ones where you talk, maybe you learn something, I don't know, maybe find out about something that you didn't know, or maybe you inspire them, you somehow offer them some kind of difference or some kind of idea, and I see the value in it, you know. I think that's a really good thing.
Again, it probably depends on the individual. Some people don't want to be taught a lesson. I remember a gentleman who was a regular on this repeater, who is now a silent key, and if you said the word antenna to him, he would say goodbye to you, because he vehemently hated talking about any aspect of how the radios worked. He would talk to you for days about some drugstore in Queens that closed 12 years ago, but not about antennas. So it depends on the individual. Some people like to talk about the weather. Some people like to talk about what they ate. I kind of like to chat about a little bit of everything. I had a real fun time at one point. I found a guy in Limerick, Ireland, on 10 meters, and I talked to him about Ireland and my understandings of it and try to glean a little bit better understanding from him, and I had a fun time. So I like to learn all kinds of things if I can. And, you know, I'll get back. I'll try and teach people stuff as well. So it's a 50-50 sort of thing.
QSL. Sounds good. I think it's not about teaching people things. It's about helping them make some discovery of something. For me, that's very fulfilling.
Yes. Well, again, it depends on a person's interest. Some people will chat philosophy. Other people will chat electronics. Other people will chat astronomy. Lots of different sub-interests on the air. And it's always fascinating to learn something new about something different. So, that's part of communicating. There are some hams that are purely into the technology. They want to figure it out. They want to build it. They want to fix it. Once it's fixed, they don't really want to talk about it because that's not what they're interested in. There are other guys who just want to talk about stuff and aren't interested in any particular fact. They're interested in memories and nostalgias and things like that. So, again, it sort of depends on the individual, and you have to kind of figure out your audience, if you will, and adjust accordingly.
I think it's about someone, like, you got to know what you want. So it can somehow find its way to you.
Well, I don't know. We've had this discussion a few dozen times. Sometimes people misunderstand what they want, and sometimes they get it completely wrong, and sometimes, unfortunately, when they get what they want, it doesn't fill the space that they expect it to fill, because it turns out it's just a replacement for something much scarcer and more valuable that really they need to fill that space with, but they don't really conclude that ever. They just keep on filling it with stuff you could buy.
Yeah, but like if somebody tells you this is what you want, you've seen it on TV many times in advertisements, that could lead to tremendous frustration. Say it really isn't what a person wants. It's what somebody told them that they should want.
Yeah, well, you're describing the advertisement world. They make billions and billions of dollars doing that for a living. So it's a very effective practice. Business makes a lot of money. Advertising makes a lot of money. Consumers lose a lot of money, and the world goes round again.
QSL. Well, I don't condone, what these companies do and other companies that do things that don't have enough of the ethical, maybe there's something in between, some kind of agreement where, advertisers and companies can somehow get along with people so we can all be happy.
Perhaps, but human beings tend to be kind of greedy, and so if they learn a way of making a profit, the tendency is to maximize the profits. They're not looking to compromise the profits. They're looking to maximize the profits. So I don't know of a company that said, you know, we built this thing, you probably don't need it, so forget about it. It's not how business tends to work. You know, if you invested stock in a company that did that, you'd be kind of upset with the people there, and you'd probably have them fired. So capitalism is what it is, and I don't see any way of mollifying it except with regulations that capitalists don't particularly like. So that's pretty much what we're stuck with. Capitalism and a lot of regulations that kind of limit the absurdity that capitalism unfurled could kind of break out and do to us here. You know, regulations are not our enemy. They're our friends most of the time. You know, there's a good reason why the Food and Drug Administration takes time before they approve drugs, because even with those delays, occasionally dangerous drugs kind of slip through that, you know, testing them for only a couple of years is insufficient. So, you know, I'm kind of pro-regulation, but then I don't own a business, so it's easy for me to say that.
QSO. Well, I know that I don't have the same opportunities as other people. When I say other people, I mean people that are in the loop of investing and business. So I guess I just have to accept it and say, well, what can I do with what I have? And is that enough? And, you know, do I need to run after things and jump and run after things and be frustrated?
Well, like the great philosopher said, life ain't fair. Anyway, David, always a pleasure. Thank you for participating tonight. It's already 10:23, and I don't want to steal away any more time for Paul. So I thank you for your participation. I thank everyone for their participation tonight. That's what makes these technical nets a technical net. And I'll be back a little bit later on to say goodnight to everyone. But now I think it's a good time for Paul WS2N to bring us the SpaceNet report.
AC2GS WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And Roy, no problem. I sit here listening to the story. Great topic to end with. I'm with you with the regulations, by the way. You have to have something. Okay, I got a few topics here we could cover. The one interesting one I found is that NASA gave out a contract for payload to a company to have this payload actually land on the moon. The contract is given out to Blue Origin, which is owned by Jeff Bezos of Amazon fame, and Blue Origin has a vehicle they plan on landing next year called Blue Moon. They have two Blue Moon vehicles under development. They have the Mark 1 and the Mark 2. Mark 2 is a ways away, of course, but Mark 1 is, they have a hardware built, and by next year they plan on sending this massive thing to the moon. They plan on launching it on their new Glenn rocket that also is new, to the point where first launch of that will be at the end of this year. But this vehicle is, well, they have the, like I said, the Mach 1 is around 30 feet or roughly around three stories high, and then you have the Mach 2, which is almost 60 feet high. Mach 2 will be the one that will carry astronauts to the moon. Mach 1 is going to be used for a cargo vehicle. You know, bring stuff to the moon. There's going to be a lot of stuff that will have to go to the moon if they ever plan on putting a base there. And Jeff Bezos is ahead of it with his cargo version. So since they plan on landing it next year, NASA said, okay, we're going to give you a contract to put a whole bunch of these cameras on the bottom of your vehicle. And they're like stereo cameras. In fact, they call it stereo cameras for lunar plume surface studies. And what they want to do is look at the surface, you know, with the regolith that's on the moon as that gets blown away with the thrust of these vehicles when they land. You know, it's important to know where the stuff is going to go, how far it's going to go. Is it just the regolith that's going to blow away, or are you going to start digging a hole below that? You know, they know on the lower thrust ones, you know, there's really no problem. You know, including the Apollo landing vehicles, they had a lot of thrust. But they put these cameras on the last Intuitive Mission company that flew or landed to the moon called Nova. That was the one that was on the news. Landed on the moon and wound up on a tilt, and the antenna was facing the wrong way, and they managed to get, you know, all the data back that they needed, but it took like, you know, a month to do, you know, instead of, you know, minutes to do. But they, you know, they had a couple of cameras on that to look at the surface when that thing landed, but that was relatively low thrust. This thing is, you know, they needed something over 8,000 pounds of thrust. And this one has that. This is probably going to be in the 10,000-pound thrust category. So it's good to see them, you know, still, you know, letting our contracts out to these different companies. One of the other companies that got a similar contract with the stereo cameras is Firefly. And they plan on launching a vehicle to the moon, not as big as this thing, but a good-sized one. And that's that'll be launched toward the end of probably the end of this year. It's called Blue Ghost, under development by Firefly. Firefly's new rocket company has launched I think 4 rockets so far from Vandenberg Air Force Base, and they've had contracts with Lockheed Martin and a couple and one director from the government. The National Reconnaissance Office is going to get involved with them. The Department of Defense gave them a contract. They had a successful launch. So they're doing good. And they're building rockets, and they're building landers for the moon, and very active. So that's good to see. So that means we should see maybe at least two lunar landing missions by the end of this year. Well, I'll keep my fingers crossed. This is WS2N.
This is Kilo Echo 2, Alpha Juliet Uniform. Paul, this is Charlie.
Good evening, Charlie. How are you? And do you have any comment about this?
Yeah, SpaceX also got a $113 million contract for satellites.
Yeah, I don't know if that was a private company that gave them the contract. That was not a government contract, right?
I thought it was a government contract with all that money.
Yeah, it might be. I'll have to look it up. But I believe it was Harris. You know, they were looking to put up a bunch of antennas, and, you know, for their company, Harris. It's actually from the old Harris Radio company. You know, they've merged and separated, and, you know, half a dozen times over the years. But we'll see. Anyway, there is another private company that just gave SpaceX a big contract, probably I'm going to guess $100 million. But they didn't say yet, but over, probably over that. And this one is being given out by this Chinese investor. You know, he's originally from China, and he's into, I think, I don't know what the heck. He's one of these guys that's into this, you know, funny money or this digital money. And he wound up becoming a billionaire. So he's got to pay Elon Musk. My guess is $250 million. They won't give the price. And what he plans on doing, he's got to take his spaceship, the Crew Dragon vehicle, with three other people. And, you know, they have a crew, and they're training for this. And, you know, they're going to try to go by the end of the year. And nobody's American. You know, he's Chinese. They've got a guy, somebody from Norway, a guy from Australia, and then somebody from Germany. I think it's two women and then two guys. And they plan on going on a polar flight. You know, most of these, well, actually all of the flights that the shuttle, you know, ever did, or any of our flights, have always been roughly equatorial. Yeah. Usually the highest we go is 51.6 degrees, which is the International Space Station. There was one NASA flight that I think they went around a couple of degrees higher. The highest one on record is Valentina Tereshchikova. She's the first woman to ever go into space with the Russians back in the 60s. And she went on, I think it was 65-so degree inclination, and spent a couple of days up there, over 40 orbits, and then came back successfully. But now this group plans on going on a polar orbit, you know, actually over the North Pole and the South Pole, which, you know, we have plenty of robotic missions that do just that. I mean, dozens and dozens of them. So I'm not sure what they're going to gain on this. I don't know if it's a stunt. It could be. I have to look into it. I don't know if it's really a good scientific reason for doing this. You know, with all our robotic satellites doing that kind of work over the North and South Pole for, you know, all kinds of reasons. You know, everything from photography to, you know, studying the ionosphere, studying the auroras. You know, plenty of satellites are doing that. But there's going to be a crew, four doing it on a 4 or 5 day mission. Now, that means they can't dock with the space station. You know, they're just going to go to orbit and come back. And looking for the point of the mission yet, so I really can't report on that. So we'll see. Very, very strange contract that they plan on doing. And they want to do this by the end of the year. Now, SpaceX has launched a lot of crews. I just read recently they were up to 13 crew missions, you know, for different, you know, some private and mostly, of course, for NASA. But, you know, up to 50 different people. Now they plan on doing this one. There's another one that's supposed to be coming up in a month or two. Again, another private one where the four crew members, two men and two women again, will try to do an EVA. So they're going to go on an extremely high altitude up there, around 800 miles out. You know, a bit of an elliptical orbit, but all the way out to 800 miles, which is high. You know, the International Space Station is roughly 250 miles up, so that's you know, I think, that mission, they're rolling the dice, and while they're doing this, they plan on doing the first private EVA spacewalk. guys doing it, and one of the women. I'm not crazy about it. So all four people have to be in spacesuits. They don't have an airlock. So we'll have to see. Interesting. Sounds like thunder out there. I don't know if it's going to get rain. Well, okay. I'll be following that mission as well. That should be in a month or so. And the one that's going to go into a polar orbit, that they say by the end of the year. But, in the space world, that could be next year. Whatever. Any comments?
Go ahead, Charlie. I heard you over the CW. Back to you.
Okay, I got a question. Now, to go up privately, how much is that going to cost per individual, and who's paying for it? He's paying for it, or is the company paying for it?
Guy is a billionaire. A rich guy. I don't know if he's a billionaire, but he got a lot of money from this crypto money nonsense. Yeah, I don't get that, by the way. But, I guess I should learn something about it. This guy's a billionaire. I'm not. Anyway, he's got all this money. He's going to pay his own money. He's going to pay to Elon Musk. Like, he needs the money, right? My guess around $250 million, and the reason I say that is because the flights up to the International Space Station, NASA pays them roughly $50 million a seat. So, you're looking at $200,000 minimum to send the crew to the International Space Station for NASA. So that's what I'm basing it on. Back to you, Charlie.
I can't see. I'd rather go someplace else than the International Space Station. It's crowded up there.
Yeah, we need either another space station or a bigger space station. Yeah, right now 9 people up there. And then you have 3 people on the Chinese one. So it's a total of 12 people in outer space right now. So, yeah. I just wanted to bring up this other topic. This RFA company is the company out of Germany that's plan on launching a rocket, eventually reusable, and they think they're going to go in a couple of weeks. They've been at this, I just read, 2018. And they're coming along with this roughly 100-foot rocket. So it's not a big rocket. It's similar to the Electron rocket that Rocket Lab flies. But they could probably put, maybe 2,000 pounds of payload into space if it's successful. And this German company, RFA, it's called Rocket Factory of Augsburg. That's where they get the RFA from. We'll be launching this from brand new spaceport in Scotland, in Saxeford, Scotland. So Scotland built this place, not necessarily just for this one company. They're just building a couple of launch complexes. Is their goal to make money. So that should be interesting. Let's see if this company is successful. And from there, they have to do polar launches. They can't launch east because there's too much land in that direction, and they'd be afraid of having something come down and on the Eiffel Tower or something. So they can go over the poles. Shoot this thing north, and it would wind up in a polar orbit. That's the plan. I'll be looking to see how they do. And, the first half a dozen flights will be expendable vehicles.
they won't be reusable, but down the road a piece, they plan on trying to make reusable rockets out of this RFA rocket. Any comments?
SpaceX fired up the Raptor this week, and this engine, they say it's... What do they mean? How much testing does it need to be certified? I've never heard of that before.
Yeah, okay, stand by 1 second, Charlie. There was somebody else in there with you. We'll get back to you. You have the station, go ahead. This is Paul WS2N for the SpaceNet report.
Good evening, Paul. This is Kilo Foxtrot 2 Zulu Zulu, KF2CC. I'm just joining in a little bit late.
Very good. Okay. Yeah, good signal. What's the name there?
Oh, yes. Name is Brian.
Oh, okay. You've checked it. I'm sure of that, right, Brian?
Yeah, I just actually was listening to the conversation. And very interesting one at that. But very little mention of the words space debris.
Oh, there's a lot of that, yes. We talk about that quite a bit. You know, Brian, we are here every week. This is the TechNet that Roy AC2GS does every week, and the tail end of it, I do the SpaceNet report, and we do talk about space debris quite a bit. You know, China just had one of their rockets blow recently, and you know. It's definitely a problem. There's all sorts of restrictions now, would be sanctions if countries decided to, you know, start shooting these things out of the sky just for the fun of it, just to see if they could do it. It has happened in the past, so hopefully that doesn't happen anymore. But yeah, debris is a problem. We've talked about. Companies, you know, who's really into trying to get the stuff out of the sky. Japan has a big space program designed to try to bring all this debris back. SpaceX, when they send their Starlink satellites up, they usually send now 20 or so at a time. They used to send 50 when they were smaller. They're designed to re-enter the atmosphere if they fail. If they don't want these things flying around up there forever. Back to you, Brian, and we have to go back to Charlie.
Yes, the SpaceX rockets, they come down and they land and they get reused. Some of the debris winds up on the Gulf of Mexico.
Okay, Charlie, I heard you. Stand by one. Back to you, Brian.
I'm listening. KF2CC, listening.
Okay, Brian. Very good. Are you coming in direct or Echo Link or different modes?
Coming in by your repeater, normally.
Oh, okay. Yeah. When I went back to you, I didn't hear you, so that's something that usually happens with the Echo Link people. Very good, Brian. Okay, let me go. Let me continue on. I only have one or two more topics I wanted to cover. One that I find very interesting is the InSight mission. InSight mission was launched a while back, back in 2016. It landed in 2017 on Mars, and that's the one that had a seismometers on board. And it operated for years, like over 3 years, recording Mars quakes, also recording sounds, not sounds, but vibrations of, you know, if a meteor hit Mars, you know, this thing would pick it up, and they've gone through all the data, you know, now for years. It's been not operating since about 2021 or so. So the data that they're combing through, they figured out that below the surface, I mean way below the surface, like 6 miles below the surface, there's a lot of water there, mixed in with all the rocks. And they said it's on a global basis, you know, the whole planet. So if you were to theoretically take all that water out of the planet and put it on the surface, they said that there would be enough water on Mars. You know, you'd have like a mile high of water all the way around the planet. So there's a lot of water there, of course. You know, when we go there, set up bases and all, that's not going to be an easy task to do. But, you know, they'll know that water is down there, but you can't really drill down six miles into the surface. You know, I mean, maybe 100 years from now or something, maybe they'll be able to do that. But at least they know there is water that is within that planet. So they're going to do more studies, and that was the InSight mission. See, some of these missions end, but the science goes on for years or decades or, you know. Anyway, any other comments? WS2N.
WB2BX.
Yeah, I had a question about SpaceX flying up a Raptor engine. How long does it take to get certified?
I hear you, Frank. Engines? Well, they're using them all the time. That is another iteration of them. They've gone through 1, 2, and now they're up to 3. Each one is more powerful, Charlie. Now we have another station, so just stand by a minute. Charlie, let me go over to Frank. Over to you, WS2R.
Yeah, very good, and you're right. The Raptor engines have been testing, and I guess they've already flown them into space 3 times. Let's see. Yeah, they've done 4 flight tests, and I think at least 3 of them actually made it past the Kármán line and got into space. So they've actually already flown those in space, which is kind of incredible. I mean, what they're doing is incredible, launching this thing that's probably about the size of New York's Federal Building into outer space. that's kind of amazing. What I'm wondering, I'm going to check with another friend of mine on this also, is while it's not practical with current technology to drill 6 miles into the Martian surface to mine the water, whether it's likely there are some vents in the surface where that water vapor is venting somewhere, it might be able to be captured. Because ironically, I think if you were to want to drill 6 miles into the surface, you would need the energy from the water below the surface to be able to run the equipment to drill 6 miles into the surface. So until somebody finds a vent where the water vapor is escaping from, it's going to be kind of difficult to do. Go ahead.
Yeah.
I think the best idea is good, you know, with the satellites that we have going around Mars, you know. By now, I think they would have detected it, but, you know, you get maybe satellites that are specifically designed for that, and maybe in the future they might be able to find it, some kind of, you know, multiple vents. That would be great. But, let me stand by a moment. Bunch of thunder. Okay, Frank, the next flight is supposed to be going up very shortly, according to one of their websites that covers a lot of, what is it, NASA spaceflight.com. It's not really a NASA site. They use the word NASA in their website. I was reading that. It looks like within a month or so, they should be able to launch the fifth Starship. I hope it gets to the common line, but they're still planning on bringing that booster back to Boca Chica, Texas, to be caught by the big arms that are attached to the launch tower. That should be interesting. Back to you, Frank.
Yeah, I think that's the hang-up. I may be mistaken, but I think that's the hang-up in getting FAA clearances to do the launch, is they want to do the return-to-launch site, the RTLS, with the booster. And I think the FAA wants some assurances that they're not going to blow up Boca Chica, trying to catch the thing and put it back on the launch pad. It's an idea right out of science fiction, and these guys want to do this for real. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah, that's, they don't want to take out Brownsville, which is a good-sized town, a good-sized city, you know. Well, maybe they'll have them, you know, have it come back and see if they get landed, you know, just off the coast somewhere. Do that, you know, one or two times, and maybe the FAA will qualify them after that. Yeah, I haven't seen that they have a go-ahead from the government yet. Well, we'll have to see. Not much more. But I have a couple of other topics. I think I'll save them to next week. You know, did want to say that Sean O'Keefe, remember him from years ago? He was the NASA administrator, you know, similar to what Bill Nelson does nowadays. And, you know, I've been concerned that maybe there's going to be a lot of government funding that might be cut, you know, with the Artemis program to send people to the moon and all. But it looks like Sean O'Keefe, which, you know, he was with Bush, you know, the Republicans. He's now come out, for the Democrats, because he sees that that group is stand to fund the Artemis program, as well as the other, you know, space missions that are being planned. Because as it was just recently, they were thinking about cutting funds. In fact, they temporarily canceled the Viper mission. That was supposed to go up the end of this year, a rover mission to ride on the moon. But now that might be resurrected by this Intuitive Machines, the one that launched the Nova probe that landed on the moon successfully but fell over. They might take it over. So we'll see. Looking forward to you know, a couple more years of doing this for Roy's TechNet. Any other last comments before I turn it back to Roy?
No, that's it. I'm sure there were some people who would be perfectly happy with blowing up Brownsville, Texas. But, I think the FAA would be happier if they did a couple more water landings first. But, SpaceX wants to push the envelope, as they say in that business, and try to do the catch now. Anyway, 7-3. WB2BXO.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, if that work was all being done on Long Island and they told me this thing was coming back to, land in Waconkomer, I'd be a little worried, you know? So, you know, you could imagine living down there, you know? I mean, it's not a very populated area, but if you're one person down there, and this thing is coming back, and you know, could go out of control. I mean, you've seen all his, some of the testing that he's done. You know, these things literally blow up when they hit the ground, and you know, they put a big crater in the ground. So we'll see. Okay, guys, 73. We'll have a good rest of the weekend. There's not much left. We only got another hour of that. We're going to turn it over to Roy. We'll be on tomorrow night for the Club InfoNet and the Swap and Shop, followed by Newsline. Over to you, Roy, AC2GS, WS2N. Back to you.
Okay, this is AC2GS. Our revels now are done. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do on the technical net and all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. I especially appreciate it. And I appreciate everyone who participated tonight. Thank you very much. We'll be back next Sunday to do it all over again. As always, I'll leave you a couple of closing lines. Dick, K2RIW, often ended his technical nets with the advice to be kind to each other. And I always like to throw in good old Epictetus. It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So try and keep your mind open, and not so open that your brains fall out, but open enough that you're interested in new ideas, and you haven't made up your mind about everything in the universe. So once again, have a great week, everyone. Stay safe. Be well. Enjoy the weather when it's enjoyable. And stay dry when you get wet outside. Have a great week, and please join me next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we do it all over again. And as always, I will be clear after I say, Slava Ukraine.
This is Kilo Echo 2, Alpha Julian Uniform, 73, and see you next week.
Kilo Foxtrot 2 Zulu Zulu, saying 73, and again, I reiterate, see you next week. F2CC, clear.
73, Brian, have a good night.